at all. It's been a while since we've seen each other. Hope everybody's doing well. We have Mike Osterling on the phone, Jay Ford. Chesapeake Bay Foundation is not going to be able to make it. He's also a new dad again, so that's exciting for him. Why don't we go around and introduce ourselves so we have it for the minute. Ben, you want to start, and we'll go up to the table.
Ben Stagg, Engineering Surveying Department.
Ellen Boland, MRC.
Andrew Button, MRC.
Lucan Bach, Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
Kim Husky, Cherrystone Aqua Farms.
AJ Rushkin, Bevan's Oyster Company, Calvert Seafood.
Russ Perkinson, Ordinary
Becky Kubins, Deputy City Attorney in Virginia Beach.
Ann Gallivan, J.C. Walker Brothers.
We also have Tony Watkinson in the audience with MRC. We do have someone on the phone, Mike Osterling, so if you guys could remember to speak into your microphone so he can participate as much as he can. So first meeting of 2020. As I mentioned in the email, really want to lead off by thanking you all for your participation last year and your patience. MRC's undergone some pretty big changes in terms of leadership. Rob O'Reilly has left. Pat Gere was here as our new fisheries chief. He will be involved somewhat. That has caused a role shift for a lot of us. To be honest, has taken quite a bit of my time as I'm doing other fisheries stuff. So the fall ended up being a little bit chaotic. I feel like this committee sort of bore the brunt of that. And again, I thank you for your patience and your willingness to continue to engage in this conversation and work with us this year as we go through this. So what we are doing this year to try to address some of those concerns is we do have more help. I have tapped some people in Andrew's shop and Tony's shop to help get agendas up, get minutes up, try to do some better responses as you guys have questions so you're not just waiting on me, because I tried not to be the weak link, but probably was a few times last fall. So I just wanted to lead with that. We had an explicit charge when we started this committee, which was we needed to get a regulation in place for renewal fees. We did that, so that was a big thing we accomplished, which was great. We also have the charge to do guidelines for renewals and guidelines for beneficial use. So those are the two things we're hoping to get done this year. And what that process looks like is we will work with you all. We will request a public hearing. We will probably do the request for public hearing in March. For renewal guidelines, the public hearing would be in April, and then we'll keep going for beneficial use. Other housekeeping items, we are, as many of you know, and also work in the middle of the General Assembly session. The next second Monday is the 9th, 10th of February, which is the day before crossover. So in the interest of everyone being able to make it and being able to devote actual brain power to this, what I strongly recommend is we don't meet in February, we come back and meet March 9th, which is the second Tuesday in March, and I think like 2 days after session ends. So you get a 24-hour respite from that, just to make things easier and also being cognizant of staff time. And that there are many of you on the dais as well, work at General Assembly and advocate for issues there. You guys will also be up there. So I will pause there and sort of take people's temperature on the next date, just so we can get that done.
Say that's a Tuesday.
It's a Monday. I believe March 9th is a Monday. I'm also going to make sure my phone is not on. Yes, March 9th is a Monday. It's the second Monday of the month. And then the hope is as we get through some of this, we will go towards more of an approach that the other committees go to, which is more of an ad hoc basis of, as we need your input and opinions on things, or as you guys want to bring issues to the committee or the commission, we will be able to convene the committee. So the idea is not that this will meet every month, every second Monday, but the hope we will get a lot of our work done in the first 6-8 months of the year, and then give you guys some time back and we meet more on an as-needed basis. Things nodding heads. Any heartburn, concerns, thoughts about that? Okay.
I think I've got a suggestion for future issues.
Okay.
Sounds like you got things planned out for the next little while. If you want to tackle some real issues, I'd say maybe a discussion about what the industry could perhaps do to make some of the equipment look better.
Some of these what look better? Sorry, I can hear you.
Well, look better in the landscape. Some people are concerned about the way the natural environment looks, and that's part of their thought of environmental quality. I'm one of those people. So I think I'd be interested in some dialogue on what could be done in those regards to make equipment less objectionable.
Okay. The other question I have for all of you is, as we plan out our year as a committee, you know, keep in mind we have the charge, are there things that you guys want to talk about? Are there issues that you want to raise with us in addition to the things that we have flagged? Russ already flagged one. Kim?
A few of us from industry met with the secretary last Friday, and I think it was, and I don't want to speak for the secretary clearly, but I think what I got out of that meeting was the administration's willingness to discuss the guidance document for SAV, and that should come through this committee.
Okay. Actually, I'm taking notes on the guidance document for SAV. I printed it out. Wondered if that might come up. Anything else? Marketing? Anything? Okay. And then last, sort of logistics things, again, referencing General Assembly, I do have to leave at 4. Ben and Andrew and Tony will still be here and the meeting can continue. I do have to duck out. All right. So, any other thoughts or questions before we go into the draft we've sent around for renewal guidelines? All right. So this document, most of it's familiar, most of it reflects conversations that have come up. Some of it is new in text, but are ideas that have come up and been voiced by other members of the committee. We have talked as a committee. Some of you also met with the secretary in November, seems like a very long time ago now, and the secretary has also expressed, I believe, to you all in that meeting, which I was not in, and to us as an agency, that when it comes to guidelines, particularly because the commission has review, and anyone can request a review, he does want some strength in these guidelines. They're not regulations, but the compromise is some strong wording and guidelines, and then working with the commission. For notes purposes, the minute, Bev Ludford has joined us. Welcome. Hopefully it wasn't too bad. So, accident can get bad. So this, sort of reflects where we are as an agency at the moment, and then did want your all's feedback on it, sort of concerns, comments, questions. Floor is yours. So if it's unanimously approved, that is great. I can get on the road to Richmond. I imagine you guys have thoughts. The other option for this is if you guys would rather, for a variety of reasons, issue your thoughts to us in print, in email, so it's not as public, that is also fine. I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but we do want feedback. Anne?
I just would like some more time.
Okay.
Receiving the document on the Thursday and trying to discuss today just doesn't give me enough time with all the players to have a decent discussion, so more time would be great.
Russ?
Just more of a question. I don't know if they have any opinion on it yet, but the second page, the number 2 item, bridge and street.
Yes.
The 100 was caught my eye, but you know, I see you've got some other wording and some other wording later and other ones. But are you sort of trying to discourage bridge and scrape, or when it occurs, sort of a recognition that they're maybe pulling a lot of resources out of the water, so you expect a lot to go back in?
So I will sort of tee this off, then I'm going to look to Ben and Andrew to talk a little bit more about this. One of our goals with this, as well as a goal that we have over the next year, is when it comes to regulations or guidelines that touch upon other things, is to try to bring it all into the same body of work. We're not talking about regulations, particularly around any sort of claiming or anything. We're not changing that. We're just trying to get them all in one document. And so what this reflects is that that this is a requirement in the law now.
Okay. All right.
Just trying to bring them all together. Looking at Ben and Andrew for anything, any expansion on that?
Yeah, that just sort of touches on reasonable shell plantings or seed plantings, which are required for dredge permits by code already. So if you weren't doing that, then that would certainly be reflected that you... the question was, is that referring to wild harvest seed? I think that would include spat-on shell planting or shell planting, basically, that sort of would define in guidance what reasonable shell planting would be for the purpose of dredging or scraping your ground there. That's sort of,
spat-on shell, wild harvest, I understand, cultured 100 bushels of seed is no way.
No. That would presumably, most people aren't sort of just broadcast planting cultured seed there, so that would be covered under a significant aquaculture operation there. This is just to sort of define a significant wild harvest or dredging scraping operation, similarly to how we were defining a significant or substantial aquaculture operation, understanding that sort of there are some leases used for one and some leases used for the other there.
Okay, since I've got your attention, I'd like to get clarification on lines 92 to 93. And this is the time period in which a production has to occur. So as I read this, for a 10-acre lease, if in year 5 of the lease, period, 10 bushels or 4,000 individuals are reported as being harvested, then the production criteria has been satisfied. Is that correct?
So give me those numbers one more time. It's a 10-acre lease.
Okay. Yep. In year 5 of the time duration, 10 bushels or 4,000 individuals are reported as being harvested, that would satisfy the production criteria.
That's a bushel of effort per acre per year. The answer is yes.
Thank you.
Doesn't have to be every year a certain amount. It's the totality of the lease for the whole term. And you could have just harvested 1 year, you could have just planted 1 year. We'll add those together, divide it by 10 years, and then divide it by the acreage. And that would give you the per bushel effort per acre per year. And it's the average over the
entire thing.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is still very minimal, but that is what it is.
Yeah, I understand that. I just wanted to make sure that I was interpreting it the same way you all are going to interpret it.
Yeah, it's hard to write that in a sentence so it's clear because you got a lot of moving parts. You got 10 years acreage, and you can do it any time during the 10 years. And I tried to write it in a way that's understandable, but that's the best I could do there. I'm open to better wording if somebody has it.
Okay. All right. My next question relate to essentially lines 127 through 152, where you're going to request a lot of documentation. There's other places where you request documentation for events. Could it be considered to delay the implementation of these guidelines for a year or two to allow industry to start collecting all that documentation? For instance, the current document says that the guidelines go into effect when the commission adopts it. Well, someone might have a renewal that comes up the week after that, and they don't have all this documentation. But if you give them a year, or 2 years to collect all that documentation, then they would be able to respond appropriately. I'm not suggesting that you change all the requests for documentation. I'm requesting that you delay implementation so that industry can see what is going to be asked of them to provide, so that if they don't already have it, they can collect it.
Ellen, that's a good point, something we can look into. We recognize that with this, after these go in, same as it's going to be with the renewal fee, it's going to take some time to ramp this up, right? We're not going to be able to pass these on a Monday, on Tuesday's commission meeting maybe, and the renewal the next day apply these. There actually, as we look through this, there may be a gap anyway, because we send out the renewal notices 3 months in advance?
2 months.
2 months in advance now. So there'll have to be some sort of delay. I think the question is how long. So that is a good point, something we can look into.
Thank you.
Mark, and then AJ?
Okay. Well, first I want to second what Ann said earlier. I think that a little extra time to go through this is good. But following Mike's deal of a line-by-line thing, and I'm not going to do many, line 102 through 105, it's just about other leases being able, you know, they're involved in the production process, mm-hmm. but not the harvesting. I don't fully understand the rationale that it needs to be immediately adjacent to. I mean, I could... I don't know now, but I know in the past, Cherrystone might have had a lease out near the mouth of Kings Creek, and maybe beyond the mouth of the bay, that was a seed clan area, and that they're moving around, certainly not adjacent to, but into the mouth of Cherrystone for grow out. And so I'm just, I'm wondering if this immediately adjacent to is leftover language, or what might be the rationale for that.
So that's language lifted directly from the code. That's where we started, was what is in code. So we have to abide by what is in code, first of all. And so that's where that comes from. That's also where the MSX and DERMA language comes from. So later we talk about, I think we get into that later. You know, can you show a rotational harvest plan? What are the other leases associated with all that? But that language comes from is establishing code.
So lines 102 through 114 are directly from 613 of the code. That's been in the code for quite some time.
But I assume at some point in talking through the issues, should the committee decide, that might be a thing they actually recommend as a code change as well. Right. I mean, it just doesn't. I don't know when that was originally done. Why immediately adjacent to was in there? Probably, I'm sure there were reasons. But it doesn't strike me that, and I can think of other examples now rather than just Cherrystone, where they're in the vicinity of, but people's seed areas and their actual grow out areas are not all that often immediately adjacent. Particularly the latter, sometimes a little closer to home.
I've had the same concerns about that section of the law, how to apply it in the past, and particularly now that we're trying to look at these more critically. And I think there are circumstances where a leaseholder has multiple leases that are adjacent to each other, and one comes up for renewal, and it's adjacent to one that maybe there's some beneficial connection. What I don't know is how to apply this when someone claims this, and they own one lease, and they're the donut hole, and there's all these other leases around them, and they say, well, all the leases around me, but their lease is not productive. And it's like, so I don't know how to apply this rationale in a logical way that makes any sense. Why it is that this lease is directly beneficial to adjacent leases that they don't even own, yet they can't meet the criteria on the lease I'm looking at. So it's a little confusing.
Would it be easy enough to document, you know, if company B has they've got their grow out area here in the Rappahannock, a little closer to the mouth and a little closer to their nursery area? They've got their seed holding area. It's another example that's currently real. They're not adjacent, in terms of sharing boundaries. But anyway, it's just highlighting again if it's in the code. But some things in the code are hard to change, and some aren't so hard.
And we do reference those, or some of those ideas, in lines 127 through line 130. So use of lease for husbandry, nursery, growing a rootstock, wet storage. So we do get into rotation with other leased areas is on 136. So we do get into some of those.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And also at lines 146 through 150.
Yep.
An operational plan with multiple leases.
Got it.
Do you have other thoughts, Mark?
No, that's all for now.
Okay, AJ?
So, I reviewed some of the document. I didn't have a chance to go through really with a fine-tooth comb, but I appreciate that, you know, we've been talking about lease renewals for a while and the fee, and you all have heard at length where I stand on this. You know, as far as the standard, and I know it's a bushel per acre per year, I get that. but when I go through some of this document that kind of fleshes that out, I'm pretty uncomfortable with a lot of this document.
Okay.
I feel like, you know, we're trying to really put a lot of specifics in here, and I'll give you an example. On page 4, as we go through this list, I think Mike was saying lines 127 to 150 or 152, but there are a lot of asterisks in here that say VMRC reserves the right to require the lease boundary reduction for renewal if the buffer area deemed too large, so on. You know, we entered into this kind of guidance document as, I think, twofold. One was to give some guidelines to the commission for renewals. The other one was bad actors. And I look at a 5-page document that's rather detailed, that it's going after good actors, going after people that are trying to do the right thing on a lease. And you know, in the real world, we go out on a lease and we might put 1,000 bushels per acre. That's a standard for the industry, maybe 2,000 bushels, depending on how soft the ground is. Well, if we do that in year 8 or year 9 of a lease, and all of a sudden there are no shows, VMRC comes out, as detailed in here, to review the lease and do an on-site visit, and they find no shells. But us, as having house shells, we put 10,000 bushels maybe on that piece of ground. But there are no shells. Are we not going to get the lease renewed? I mean, I think as much as we're trying to make this quantitative and have a standard and do all this, it's subjective. It's qualitative. So then, as the person that's reviewing these renewals understands that, well, there's a business that has leases and they're in the business, this is what they do, and this, so he might make a phone call, I get it. But if there's a company over here that has maybe 6 or 8 leases, might not know as well, he might call and say, well, you know, I mean, we went out and reviewed the lease, but there are no shells there. Well, you'd require documentation. What if that person doesn't have that documentation after so many years? I just think I'd like to see it simplified. I'd like to see us say, you know, and I'll give you an example, or maybe not an example, but a suggestion. Might not go over all that well, but, you know, some deference to the industry that has been in the business and is doing the right thing to say, if one of your individual leases meets this productivity standard, that the balance or the entirety of your leases under that leaseholder name should be considered productive. And I think we've talked about that before. I think, in fact, that was brought up in Richmond with the Secretary's work group. I think we're getting a little bit away from where our goal was in the beginning, and that's bad actors, and that's guidance for commissioners.
So just to repeat that point back, this has come up before, I think there's been a lot of heartburn from other people, is that if one lease meets the production requirement, then all other leases from that leaseholder should be renewed, because I mean these also all renew on different timelines, which is a whole other issue. I mean there are some I think it's something we can think about. I mean, I think that that
well,
has, could
this,
have some pretty big
okay.
impact.
So that's maybe a big jump, right?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. If there's one really productive lease and it exceeds the standard by X amount,
okay.
would you then apply that to the rest of the leaseholders' leases?
I think we'd have to think about that. That hasn't, as far as I can recall, that idea hasn't come up yet, so we can...
Again, you're... We're looking at a document that is intended, for the right reasons, to go after bad actors and people that aren't doing the right thing and give guidance to the commissioners, not penalize the existing industry that are trying to do the right thing out here and propagate shellfish.
Mark?
This is, first of all, to explain, this is for discussion purposes. This is not a VIMS point of view. We're not strongly, this body right now does not have a big representation from small growers. And I just want to throw out, for conversation purposes, a counter argument to what, or a counterpoint rather than an argument to what AJ just said. I think many that are new in the industry and trying to get started in the industry, while not at all disparaging the established industry members of the pioneers in this field and that are productive, would likely counter that last argument by saying, you know, there's a historical situation in this state where a relatively small number of people hold really large areas of lease bottom that has little to do with the current industry and more to do with the historical industry that was moving larger volumes of small shale. Now, whether they're right or wrong, I don't know. This is just an argument I've heard, and I want to make sure the discussion happens. Because that last argument, I think you could find scores of new members in this industry that would be vociferously opposed to that argument. And I'm not opposed to it. I'm not taking the side one way or the other, nor is VIMS. I just want that, I didn't feel like that was necessarily going to get out, that it's a reality of this new industry that's growing. There's a lot of people that want to get in it, that there are historical, large areas of historical leases that are remnants of what is largely an extinct old fishery. Largely, not entirely, the transport of wild seed. So that's, I just didn't want the conversation to stop there, because I think that others that aren't here would express this in their view.
Okay.
I would argue that myself, wearing my other hat, is one of the new growers.
I would say
Bev might be. So I think there's fair representation here. And I'd still argue that I would agree with AJ's point that if we could take the total, if our total acreage that I'm holding,
mm-hmm.
and if there's no wiggle room in the one bushel per acre, I'd rather see it being able to use all my acres instead of just that one lease that's coming up for renewal. Because I am new at it. Sometimes I'm not, there's 1,000 reasons why you might not be able to get an oyster or a clam to market. And I don't want to be penalized in one area if for, I have up to 5 years to get, my best management practices, I have up to 5 years of getting something harvested, allowing that ground to heal before I plant again. So that 10 years isn't a pretty big window, especially for us small growers. I might only get one crop in before it gets renewed. So I rather judge it on the health of my entire company and that I'm doing everything than just on that one lease.
Good point.
Bev and then Kim.
One of the things that occurred to me, I do think about this sometimes at the weirdest terms, in the weirdest ways. It seems to me that we should be looking at some efficiencies for VMRC as a government agency, and looking at the fact that, you know, I might have 6 leases and that they're all somehow or other tied together in what the overall operation of the small oyster harvester and educational and all the different roles that we play. that it might be more reasonable to look at all of a particular, like Bev Ludford's leases and what they're all being used for and what they're doing in this plan, and then allowing that same overview to apply to the lease renewals in the future, so as not to create more work for a very small staff looking at things as if they don't know what's going on. We're fortunate, as we've talked about in the past, to have someone who has the historical background, but somebody who walks in brand new to that position isn't going to have that. And so it's more the leaseholder's plan overall than it is the individual one at a time looking at type things, so that in my mind, being a retired state administrator, I think about how much more productive and efficient it would be to have Bev Ludford in a folder with her leases and her plan, and then when they come up for renewal, not asking for a whole new package of materials, but rather saying, well, you know, we renewed the lease last year and she talked about these other three leases and what the relationship was and so forth. You know, am I making any sense? That it doesn't seem to me that we should be renewing a lease that is used for supporting the total operation without regard to the fact that in 18 months another lease is going to come due for renewal and we have to start all over with our propaganda of, or whatever you want to call it, of the story. You know, the story. Does that make any sense?
It does.
It does. And Ben is taking notes, which are very helpful, but I'm also looking at him because he is the one that is largely doing this work.
I'm going to give him an example, Ben. If I said, you know our operation, you know what we're doing, you know where we work, you know what we do where we work, and that's wonderful because we can have a conversation and say, well, at the two leases that are right there, you know, contiguous right in Broad Bay, you know, we're growing out oysters that we have moved there from the area that has conditional closures. You know, I tell you all this for a lease renewal, and then 18 months from now, I tell you it all again for another one that comes due that's already been explained. Do you know what I'm saying, Ben? Wouldn't it be easier to have Bev Ludford's folder and know what she's doing on all her leases?
Sure. So my response to all of these comments, which are all related, Mark, AJ's, Ann's, and Beverly's, is that I think lines 127 through 152, which is the other factors, encompass a lot of this. Maybe it's not written in a way that y'all are comfortable with yet, or maybe we can get to that. But particularly down near the bottom of 146, where it talks about an operational plan. And, you know, I don't want to force industry, although we may be headed that way with use plans for new leases and transfers, but if you could create an operational plan that encompasses exactly the kind of stuff y'all are talking about, your big picture, what you do, how you do it. I don't want any proprietary information, but a general operational plan. You could certainly submit that once, or send me a copy every time you have a lease comes up. So either I see it and I'm reminded, you know, that you have one of these. You could say, well, we'll just keep it on file, you know, and every time you send a renewal in, pull out my operational plan. That's logistical on how we do it. But that was, I think, the purpose of how I tweaked these a little from the last time you had it. And I understand your heartburn about the buffer and reducing the size of the lease. I knew that'd be controversial. I just hate to see a 250-acre lease that someone is harvesting all the oysters off one little section of it and then claiming and then not planning it. And it's a bad actor, okay? It's a bad actor scene. And they get to keep the whole lease. When we could say, well, what part of it is if you're really working? And if it's self-reproducing or you are putting sale on it, but the rest of it's mud, We'll give you a buffer. We understand there's a lease next to you you're worried about. But that other 150 acres, do you really need to keep it? Maybe there's some better purpose for that. Maybe it's aquaculture. Maybe it's some other fishing device. Who knows? That's my thinking, okay, behind this. So maybe there's a better way to get at this, what you're all suggesting. But again, look at this section and tell me, you know, in the future, I know you didn't have it for very long, what can we do to make it better here to address these issues I think you're coming up with? I understand them, and I do that now. You're right. I know your operation. I know your, you know, I don't really need to call you when I get one. I pretty much know your, kind of know your operational plan, but I won't be here forever. So that's my comment on it.
I think Kim was next, Russ, and then AJ.
And I'm going to yield just momentarily to Mark, and then come back.
Because it's just, I just want to ask you a question. In following the situation that Bev talked about, and maybe she had, among these leases, they're all due on, many of them are due on different years. Do you have the flexibility, if you wanted to roll, I mean, they're still separate leases, but advance the renewal of the others? Could you get them all on sequence? Could you renew one earlier, in other words, so that if she had that group of five that were all in her plan and she requested it, she could come up for renewal early on some of them so they were all renewed at once?
I think that's a legal interpretation of the law that I would defer to Kelsey, the attorney general, to tell me how much discretion do we have here.
It could also be costly for the...
Because you'd be paying for it all at once.
Right. So we can... that's a question we would definitely send up to council. And I think it would... For that very reason, when we were working on the renewal fees and people were very concerned about them coming all due at once, that I think it would have to be very optional of if a company wanted to, for streamlining purposes or paperwork, to be like, we're gonna bite the bullet once every 10 years, we'd have some wiggle room. But particularly because we've already gone through all the renewal fee stuff,
okay.
I'd have to, let's run that up through council. Well, we can run that up through council, but I'm...
Well, an industry might not want it, I just...
Right.
And the flip side of that is, as companies change ownership, transfer leases, say there's a company that's been in business forever and they've got 10 leases and they've aged out. They just don't want to do it anymore. And one of the other companies comes and says, we'll buy all your leases. Well, they're buying 10 leases with the same, you know, so the tendency in the industry is as leases change hands and companies, you know, the bigger companies buy a lot of them, they end up having a lot of leases that will come up. They'll all come up at the exact same time. C.C. Conway died and his grandson inherited it. We transferred all of those leases at one time, so they almost all have the same renewal date. So, you know, that's a big chunk of change somebody's going to pay when they all come up at the same time.
Sure. That's a good question. So, I share... and AJ and Bev's concerns, again, just briefly having been able to review the document. And I think I've said this before, whereas that I understand this is a guidance document, but guidance oftentimes turns into policy. And I have, I guess, one of my concerns, or is assumed to be policy, is that one of our goals for the document is to guidelines for the commission. I think that's probably not only Ben, but commissioners as well.
Yes.
So that when a renewal is denied and it does come before the commission, commissioners are sitting up here. Commissioners often not very well steeped in our business or our industry are looking at lines 127 through 152. And for some reason, there's something, and I understand that there's. It also seems other fact says other factors not within these guidelines, if deemed appropriate, is that this is it. You know, in their minds, they're sitting up here and they look at this, and there are other reasons, such as AJ referred to, that the lease was Shell, but Shell was in mud and it wasn't done a good job, and maybe what. The shell is from within your own company, and you don't have a document where you purchased that shell. Well, then I'm just concerned that this document is too cumbersome, too detailed, and that if there could be a way that we could streamline it for guidance purposes, not only just Ben and staff, but also for commissioners, I think that would. Better. And I've said it before, I'm still concerned with the quantitative figure, the quantitative numbers of one bushel per year per acre. I think a lot can go wrong with that. And I do have one question for Ben, if I can concede for just a minute. Ben, if the second part of our task is to get rid of bad actors, have applications declined? Have renewals declined?
Renewals really haven't changed because they're just coming up automatically.
Okay,
from
right.
30 to 40 a month, and that's just the nature of the way the lease system is. That's
have people chosen not to renew because of the renewal fee?
Well, we always have had that. We've always had occasionally someone will send the form back and say, no longer interested in keeping the lease. They don't even attempt to put anything on it. Just put right on there. I'm done. I don't want to mess with it anymore. I haven't really seen much change. Most people are sending the form back and the check and hoping you know, that I'm going to approve it. Now, I have gotten some that I'm not going to be, I'm not comfortable approving based on what they've submitted. But I had those in the past. The difference is now they've paid $150, and then I'm going to add insult to injury and tell them they're not going to keep their lease. But that's the way law and the regulations written. It's non-refundable, basically, unless they ask for a hearing and the commission agrees to reinstate it or give them their money back, which could happen.
Well, what about the applications? Lease applications.
Applications are down this year from historic high levels we had been seeing, but they've been trending, they were already trending back down some the last 2 years. Just having 300 plus applications a year is over, I think. One, because we've kind of run out of ground that's really suitable, unless people start going out in the bay. If we start doing deep water leases, all bets are off. Leases may go back up. So yes, the numbers, but it's too soon for me to say for sure when the fee just went up, you know, March 1st, that this year is that much different than last year. There's a few less this 2019, but I saw that curve coming back down already. I think it will reduce the number long term. Traditionally, you've heard me give this speech before, but if you run numbers for 10-year increments, the average, even with the big boost in the 2006 through 10-ish on into now, where it boosted up for a number of years, you know, our average applications were really about 90 to 120 a year. We skyrocketed for a number of years there where we were, you know, 200, 300. But that's kind of an anomaly. So my guess, and I don't have a crystal ball going forward, is that we will probably not see over 100 applications a year anymore with the fee structure down now. We'll see lease consolidations. I'm seeing that already. People are asking to add contiguous leases together. I think that's a reaction to the $150 fee, is that in the long run, if you can meet the production and you have five leases and you create one, well, you just saved yourself $450 fees down the road for a minimal fee to consolidate.
So that's interesting, and I know that's been happening.
Yep.
So when you consolidate all those leases, where does that start year one, and then with one consolidated lease,
It's also a way to sort of beat the 10-year renewal. 10 years?
Yeah. You start at one when you consolidate, year one?
Yep.
And we've had an internal discussion about that. The renewal law is not really clear about, renewing a lease is not a new lease. It's still the same lease, but your renewal date is every 10 years.
Right.
It's renewed, you just start 10 years over. Transfer is clearly a new lease, so you start over. A consolidation, in the past, we've said we created a new lease out of all these other leases. It starts 0 year for 10 more years. We've had some internal discussion about, well, is this the latest way to circumvent the 10-year renewal? And could we legally take the stand that we will consolidate all these, but we will give you a renewal date that's the least onerous on our perspective? In other words, you know, one comes up in 5 years, one comes up in 6 years, one comes up in a year. You know, we're gonna make you still meet the worst case one for all of them put together. And that might not be fair, even that. So, depending on what you're adding together. So, and I'm not even sure in the current law whether we can do that or not. That's obvious when you create a new lease from a bunch of other leases, it's...
Sounds like we will add that to the list of things we'll be running by Kelsey.
Sorry, I get a little carried away when I talk about
that. No.
It's a real thing.
And as we talked through this since the beginning of the governor's working group, as we've gone through all of this, there's all, like, for the challenges with bad actors, it's always been a bit of a cat and mouse game, right? Like, we will do what we can to address those without trying to freeze out good actors. You know, but as I sort of joke, sometimes people are pretty, can be very, very smart when they're trying to legally get around the law. So that is the balance we're trying to strike of how can we address bad actors. But like so a situation like that, depending on how often it's happening, you know, I think there's a real need for people to be able to consolidate their leases. Are we going to want to come down gangbusters on that for a few bad actors that could punish the whole industry? So we are trying to strike that balance. But that actually is a legal question we probably should run to ground. Kim, did you have other thoughts? Or are you okay, Russ?
I've got just a clarifying question, depending on the response, may have a comment. But on page 4, these additional factors that people have been talking about, do they only kick in really if it's if somebody's making an inadequate effort,
for
marginal
pretty
effort?
Pretty much, yes. If you have harvest
to plant or
a bushel
or something
per acre per year, you're in. Even with no planning, no nothing. I mean, that's a minimal effort.
All right. Well, basically,
you have
that,
a combination of the two, yeah, you're in. But if you say, you know, I had a quarter of a bushel of effort per acre, well, that's not enough. But I did some of these other things. Or
well, that's how
operational plan.
Interpret it. I just want to make sure. But you know, so that being the case, the only one that sticks out like a sore thumb is right in the middle of that list on page 4. Float, rather permitted. You know, if somebody's got floats, I would think they're probably meeting the one bushel an acre of effort. But, you know, just if they're doing anything, unless they got floats out there, they're not putting anything in. And it would be a problem. But the rest of them seem to, you know, be, you know, we can disagree about individual ones or something. Just looking at the group as a whole, I think the float one is the one that sticks out. And I know you said before it's because VMRC's record keeping system, you know, if somebody different has the permit and the person leasing lets them use it, it doesn't necessarily get accounted for. I would encourage you to take floats out of the list and fix your record keeping system so the two systems talk to each other so that there is credit given to the leaseholder if there's production occurring on their lease, even if somebody else is the operator of it, you know, by agreement, and including permits, you know, for things like floats. Thank you.
So just quickly, comment on that. And
I have some heartburn with this one, too, because the only reason we lease bottom is to grow oysters on the bottom, or in cages, they're sit on the bottom. It has nothing to do with floats. So you can get a float permit over your own lease. You can get a float permit over somebody else's lease if they agree. You can get a float permit over a non-lease bottom. So there's that conundrum of, but we know a lot of people are doing aquaculture floats on over their leases. And they want to get some credit for that, even though, should they? I mean, that is a question. Because they don't really need the lease. And I have a transfer pending right now from a company that is those cages, but they say the lease they're going to get, They're not going to do traditional shelling, and they're not going to put cages on it. They want to get it to put floats on it. Should I transfer it?
They're propagating oysters. Why not? That's what the whole purpose of.
No, that's true.
Yeah, that's
but they don't need the lease. They're going to have to get a permit anyway.
I don't understand. They don't need the lease in order to get a permit.
To do floats.
Of course, you'll issue the permit without it. But then are you going to, is there any condition after that in which you would lease that bottom to somebody else? I would think I'd want the lease for safety to cover my tail.
And we understand that. And that is why a lot of companies have both a bottom lease and a float lease. But the code doesn't sync up very well there on, and it comes back to mandatory reporting. They're going to report the float oysters from coming off of that lease. I guarantee you. That's because we asked, what lease did it come from? Or did it come from non-lease bottom? And if it did, you have to say where, because you got to have a permit. If they're reporting it correctly, you put the permit. But I guarantee you, a lot of people are putting the lease. So you're right, we could fix our records or make it easier for us to discern. And I agree. I think logically, in my mind so far, what difference does it make? They're growing oysters, and they're over top this lease. So give them credit for it. I know Russ doesn't necessarily, I think, agree with that. But I'm open to anything
so
anybody has an
so
idea.
So
you
wouldn't say don't give them credit
right.
for it on the lease. I just don't think you need this.
Okay.
I think you need to fix your internal systems so they talk to each other.
AJ actually put his hand up, so AJ and then Mark.
So I had a number of things I wanted to say, but just based on what we just talked about, the floats aren't floating out there by themselves and going to stay on that lease. So you have to go down to the bottom somehow, some way. I don't care how you're going down there. We don't culture things floating, but you're going to go into that bottom, and that's the lease ground. So you're going to have, in my opinion, have to have both. You know, the lease on the bottom and
the permit would allow you to anchor them. So the permit would be your document that allows you to put something in the bottom.
But if you farm it into the bottom, you'd have to lease it. But anyways.
So let me see if I can what Ben is saying is if you don't have the lease bottom, we can issue you a permit to affix structures to the bottom, to affix the poles to the bottom to float. What I hear you all saying is that's fine. We want to be able to have that bottom, to have those floats over it, to be able to have that security. So Ben is saying what is possible, but I hear you guys saying what gives you more business security.
Well, right? doesn't the permit basically allow you to lease the water column? So it's kind of a moot point. You can't do anything else on the bottom, essentially. But that wasn't my purpose for raising my hand.
Okay.
So I just want to make another comment, if I can. Basically, go back to Mars. There's a lot of wild seed that's moved in this state privately, and I point to Andrew for that. We move a lot of seed, as you know, out of the Rappahannock, out of the Great Wicomico. It's highly productive. It's self-sustaining. We haven't planted a shell at Deepwater Light, and it's extraordinarily, outside the last maybe two seasons with low salinity, highly productive. The other point I was going to ask is this document, mm-hmm. I think I made this point before, maybe not, can it go to SMAC as well? I know we're AMAC, I get it, but SMAC has a lot of members in there that lease ground, and I think they'd be very interested in this document.
It's like you're reading my notes, AJ. I actually just, I was having that thought, I turned to Andrew, the next SMAC meeting is the 22nd. And this document will come up at that meeting. And hearing the feedback from you all, we will send it out earlier than the Thursday before the meeting. Okay. We will work on that.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, Andrew's on it.
And just to sort of touch on your question there, about 30% of, based on 2018 numbers, of private ground production is actually containerized on culture or other. Roughly 70% is still traditional harvest methods. But a big chunk of that does come from the river. So aquaculture still hasn't exceeded wild production, even on private ground, in terms of containerized.
Quickly, as a
includes span on shell, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yes, so that includes span on shell, but that's probably another 10-15%.
Okay,
so.
All right, thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, I do have to step out. I will listen to this meeting and to hear the rest of it. I do want to put a sort of a deadline down because we would love any additional written thoughts that you all have. So again, I recognize we're in the middle of General Assembly, which is taxing, I know, for us and y'all, and we're not revisiting this again until March. Is February 3rd, that's 3 weeks from today, a reasonable time? Okay. February 3rd to get us feedback. We will send out a reminder a week before. So, well, the 20th is, we'll send out a reminder the 27th. For mm-hmm. And it can come to me, and I will farm it out, or you can CC people accordingly.
And you said SMAC meeting was scheduled for?
The 22nd.
January? Yes.
So if you have a working document, are you going to send out a working document when you make the changes that we can keep revising, or you just want revisions on this and then we're not going to see it again until March?
We want revisions. That's a really good question. I will probably circle with staff after this meeting. I think we will send out a working document. We will send out this document that you all have. We will take feedback on that, and we will send it out again well in advance of March. So we hopefully have time for two rounds of edits. You can also always call any of us to talk. If you don't have time to enter, you can always call any of us, and we're willing to do that as well. So we'll try to commit to two rounds of edits. But again, the next steps for this, once we go through this, is there will be a request for public hearing, and then there will be a public hearing in front of the commission for them to adopt them. So there will be two additional points of contact with the commissioners in addition to staff. Yes, and
two brief comments. I think a lot of the documentation that we see on page 4 is a lot still, especially on a 10-year lease. You might have documentation 9 years ago, and then remembering to put it in the folder to have it is a lot. And to on AJ's point, even small companies have shell the bottom that we wouldn't have documentation. So there's a lot of it requested. We wouldn't necessarily have documentation. And then I like that you touched on natural disasters or weather events. I know it's in code for MSX and dermo, but I think there's a lot going on in the water that causes mortality beyond MSX and dermo. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to touch on emergent diseases or just mortality events in general. And again, that would be hard to have documentation, but there's summer mortality, there's a triploid mortality that wasn't necessarily documented, and I still know people that are dealing with it that don't know how to approach NIMS to have it documented that they have. So you have an active board here, but there's a lot of people that are intimidated by NIMS or intimidated by VMRC to go talk to them. So I think there's a lot of mortality events that might not be on record with you guys until the 10-year renewal. They'll say, well, we lost everything for a few years. Every May, just all of a sudden, it up and died. But you wouldn't know that. Or they might be too embarrassed, or they don't want you to know that they didn't have production because they might not meet that threshold. I think there's new diseases and diseases, even SSO, QPX, there's a whole slew of stuff. So sure. Mark can be a little bit more eloquent about it. But
well, I'm just going to agree. I mean, there are times people have lost everything in May due to a mahogany tide.
Fresh water.
Wait till it gets warmer and the drills start killing you again. somewhere broadening that definition. I mean, and hopefully we can somehow make it clear that documentation isn't that hard to get, hopefully. I mean, I agree with your perception, but it is the type of thing. You know, when a fair number of people used to have the crop insurance, so that since you seed insurance, you know, we've got to formally document that as in order to do that. But yeah, there are a lot more things enlisted in this.
Well, especially for you mentioned new growers, and you were concerned about a new grower would be even more mortified to speak up and say, oof, I lost everything.
Yep.
I think the stigma there.
I think you're right.
I did write that down, perhaps broadening or re-looking at the extreme weather, other event type scenario.
Well, it sounds like I'm kind of hearing two different things from different folks there. So in terms of those other guidelines that we have there, I'm hearing that there's not enough there and that there's also too much, or is it there's too much so there shouldn't be anything? So I'm kind of hearing there's all these other things, but also that, you know, everything on there is too much, that there's too much there in the first place. So it's sort of like I'm just looking for some clarification on whether the consensus up there is that there's too much there or there's not enough there.
I only want to provide clarification, I think, on one bullet, the last one. I think you maybe well capture, I don't put words in Ann's mouth, that says extreme adverse and or catastrophic weather events. Just take weather out of it.
Events.
Because there's a lot of them that aren't weather. I mean, that's not trying to add more. That's trying, in some cases, to make them more generalized. And I think there have been times that I don't have a specific example, that AJ has suggested that some of these needed to be more generalized rather than as quite as specific. But I don't know that I recall which ones you were talking about.
I might have been the one that said, you know, it'd be nice to have a simpler document, but I understand the need to maybe spell some of these things out. I do agree with emerging diseases. I just think it's around the corner for us, much like MS6 and Dermal was, you know, and hopefully we don't see those, but unfortunately I think they're ahead. You know, I don't mind having a list like this, but sometimes you put a whole list together, an exhaustive list, and you spend a lot of time on it, and then all of a sudden a commissioner or somebody in the staff says, this wasn't really pointed out here, and then all of a sudden we're in a box. Maybe that's the catch-all of all other, you know, things, but I agree with Ann, there are a number of other issues that are there. So I don't have heartburn in spelling things out. My point was more generally, I guess, that, you know, I don't want to see us hurt the existing industry. I understand there are new people getting into the industry. There are people getting into the industry that want to do floating gear. There's people in the industry that are growing off bottom that want to do floating gear. I mean, a number of different things. Not to be on the soapbox too much, but Virginia's done the right thing with leasing ground. We are the envy of the entire, I would be safe to say, the entire country, from the Gulf to the West Coast, certainly, and up and down the East Coast.
Yeah, we don't want to screw that up, do we?
No, thanks.
I agree with that.
So I just want to bring back the municipal focus here, which is in 2014, when the ability of a locality to acquire any lease bottom for a public purpose of any type was taken away, it became, I think, more incumbent on the industry to say and be very clear about how and why and in what manner you're using these leases. So one of two things either has to happen. You have to show exactly how you're using them interchangeably. You know, I don't want to see, just because you're a big industry producer and you have a lot of production in one lease and then a completely remote lease that is by no means being used, that it somehow gets the blessing to stay leased. And it could be the difference between having a needed navigational aid and not having it, because we've run into that, where if we have no way to get the permission for that sort of thing, even with the one that we fixed, with dredging, that's still a very difficult and cumbersome process that has yet to be tested. So my position is, it may be cumbersome, but the way to fix it is not by not requiring documentation if there's no evidence of production. It's by making the bookkeeping easier. You know, make it so that people can submit their records immediately so that they don't have to keep them. Make it so that they're prompted to submit leases during harvest, you know, every opportunity on your website and everything, to make sure that people are keeping track of it. But I don't think the answer is to just give a presumption that
because you're not a bad actor, which I would like to also say again, I don't think there's bad actors and good actors. There is no legal mechanism where you can hold a lease and be deemed a bad actor. There's no, you know, governing body that will do that. If you're not one or the other, sometimes you are just somebody operating within the law in a way that conflicts with the way somebody else wants you to use that. And it's perfectly legal, and it's not a bad thing. It's just different than what somebody else has needed at that moment in that particular place, like for a navigational aid. So I like having the specificity. I know, Ben, you're not going to, you know, want to have this job for the next 50 years. I want there to be some consistency and some good discussion and some transparency to the other members of the public that as to how each lease is being used, why it's needed, and why you haven't been able to produce anything for over 10 years, which what we've all agreed is, by all accounts, I think a relatively low bar if you're in there. And I know there are exceptions, and I think we've listed quite a lot of them here if you haven't been able to show that, and even a basket for those that aren't shown here. So, but I don't think we should get to the point where, unless you want to reverse the eminent domain action, right. I just don't see how you can get away with doing that anymore.
So a couple of quick comments. The reason you got this revised document that seems a little more strict, I'll use that word, was, you know, I was told that this document needed to have some teeth. More than it had. We sent this up to the Secretary's office, and they came back down that first they wanted a regulation. They preferred a regulation over a guidance document. We did convince them, I think, at the moment that maybe a guidance document would be enough. But we were told, well, it's got to put a little more teeth in it. And I don't know necessarily that we were told to get rid of the bad actors. I don't know that that was really a word that was used. I agree, it's very difficult to really specify what a bad actor is, particularly if they're operating within the law. So I just want you to understand that's where some of this came from. Understanding that we knew some of this, y'all would push back and say, you know, I'm not too thrilled about some of this. But it's open for discussion. The other concern I've had all along with trying to come up with these rules is that, in essence, and this goes back to the comments we've had earlier, if this thing is adopted, and I understand what Mike said, could we have a year sort of hiatus in implementing it to give people time to get their records straight? The law has changed, and we're implementing it now under the current law on leases retroactively. There's no way to go around it. Everybody's in their 10-year lease right now that's coming up for renewal. And some people are 6 months away, and some people are 9 years and 6 months away. Well, the 9 years and 6 months, they will have time to react to this and start keeping records. But you're right. The people who are coming up right now probably don't have this. If they can't hit the production level, they probably don't have a lot of this other documentation that we're requesting. And I understand that, and I have heartburn about it because I'm the guy that's got to sort through all that when the lease is up for renewal 6 months from, you know, from now, and I'm trying to use the current law because that law is now in effect. And I raised this issue when the bill was going through, that, you know, is this going to be applied retroactively? And I didn't get a real good answer at the time, but it is the law now. And there is no caveat in it that says this will take effect upon your next, you know, you get the current one under sort of the old, less stringent rules, but the next 10 years will be under the new law, whatever guideline document might go with it, or just what the law says. So I understand your frustration and the fact that we're trying to write a document that one size fits all, and it's retro. You know, you got to go back in time and say, well, you should have been doing all this stuff. Why would you? So that's all I'll say about it, but we're trying to come up with a document that is fair, does address the things. I mean, the law does, I think, anticipate that we look at these differently. And certainly the current administration says we should look at these differently based on the law. So that's where we are at the staff level. That's why we have this committee. That's part of your charge, is to help us come up with something that everybody can live with, probably nobody will like.
Ben, do you not think line 153, that the commission consider other factors not within these guidelines, is, should the commission choose to, their easy out for not penalizing somebody who comes up in 6 months and says, I've done this, this, and this, but I don't have documentation. It's hard to predict what any given commission is going to do, but that one, I don't think I've seen any commissions.
Right, and we put that in there. Because you all had that comment. You know, what about if something new comes up or there is a catastrophic event? It's not weather. Okay, it was good. We take weather out. I'm fine with that. It does give them an out. It gives everybody an out. I would think industry would say the staff is going to deny it because you don't have the documentation. And now I have to go to the commission and make my argument. And I don't really know how to get around that.
I don't see that. I think that if my lease comes up in 6 months and I don't have the harvest necessary, but I can, submit what we've been using the lease for, and it meets some of those points in the other circumstances, and I either sign it or have it notarized and submit it, I think that's documentation. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I think that a person who hasn't done anything at all is not going to be able to submit evidence of any kind, whether it be, records of purchase of shell or records of educational sessions or records of using it for all these different possible reasons, which are one of the and other uses type things. I think if I submitted that, would you not accept that?
Yes, and I have in the past, and I still do now.
I think your successor will.
And everybody says, well, you won't be here forever. Well, someone else will be here after me, and I hope they will have some reasonable sense of how to do this job.
I don't think you like to be in front of the commission and have your decision reversed, do you?
Well, not particularly.
I didn't think so.
We're going to have to come to the commission, and they're going to get up and say a bunch of things at the commission that they never gave me.
Right.
They had just told me this information.
Exactly.
I could have made a more informed decision.
I can just imagine, I'm being funny now, but we need a little levity at times. I can just imagine me bringing in these 50 kids, from the Friends School, with all their little stories about the oyster farm that they're planning and watching grow and everything in front of the commission, and you saying, oh, gee, I wish you'd have mentioned that to me.
Yeah. Well, I know what Mrs. Eager would say. Why are we here?
That's right.
Why didn't we know this? I'm like, and I bet them say, I don't know why I didn't know.
And I think you're going to ask, aren't you? You're going to ask. You're going to say, what have you been doing with this?
Right. And that's the conundrum I'm in right now. So I'm getting some both transfers and tenure renewals, where people are still filling it out the way they used to fill it out. And they're saying they have no mandatory reporting, so they have no production, but that they planted a bunch of seed. But they don't even put any amount. They just say, yeah, I planted some shell. And I'm like, in the past, I had better things to do because the law was pretty weak. I just approved them. I took them at their word. But you could certainly lie, and you can still lie. But, now it's like, no, this is not quite enough. If you're going to tell me you did it, understanding that I don't want to be retroactive. Okay? I don't want to say, well, where are your documents where you bought the seed or you bought the shell? I'd like to see that if you have it. But if you don't, give me some realistic numbers. And more than likely, I'm going to approve it still. We are definitely erring still on the side of industry with this law. I can tell you that. Take it home and look at it and tear it up some more and send us your comments. You won't hurt my feelings, anything you say. I did write a lot of this, but, I also was directed to write some of it, too. So I'll say that when I don't like what you say.
Well, I hate to put that in there.
Don't put that on the record.
Anything else on this one that we want to specifically talk about? We did get a heads up that SAV was an issue from the meeting last week, and we brought the document with us just in case. We wanted to go down that rabbit hole today, but I think what Helen said is true. We definitely, you know, I mean, this would be the logical place, this committee, to have a future discussion about the current document and what you think is right and wrong with it, whether it needs to be modified.
Can we submit our comments on the SAV document to guidelines?
Sure.
While we're at it.
Does everybody have it or know where they can find it?
No.
It was adopted by the commission. It should be on our website.
It is.
On the website.
It's in the regulation section there.
Can you send it around just to make sure?
Sure.
Anything else on people's minds today while we're here? Yeah, Russ.
Are we down to the number four agenda item, other matters? Just trying to know. I don't have to figure where we are.
At the agenda,
anyway,
so I don't know what you said.
I have another matter I guess I'd like considered. I've been on this committee since the inception. I plan on continuing to participate. I've been to every meeting so far, as I know a few other people here have as well. One observation is there's a well-represented industry contingent on this committee, and I feel like I'm probably the only person on the committee who really tries to represent riparian landowners and perhaps to some extent other users of the resource. I understand there was a resignation, the vacancy, I think it was one of the oyster companies a few months ago, back last year, that said they couldn't really participate because they hadn't been able to make it to any.
That was Tom Perry. Susan
Perry. So
he agreed to be on it, but he never came to a meeting, and then he resigned.
I would like to suggest that you put another riparian property owner on it. Property in my family is mostly in conservation uses, and we want to keep it that way. So, there may be other perspectives out there. People have homes on the water or other property in it that I feel like could benefit the committee. I'm not asking for equal representation. I realize it's still going to be heavily weighted towards the industry as far as membership of the committee. But I feel like if I had to miss a meeting for some reason, I'd be kind of concerned because I don't think there'd be any voice here. And I'm not planning on missing any, partly because of that, but
right.
You never know. And just a thought, a committee this size, I think, it puts a lot on me to try to find out what people are thinking that are not industry people that are concerned about the resource and concerned about the impacts, of the industry. And if you're interested, I have some possible name suggestions sometime. Thank you.
Okay. So in light of that, does anybody else on the committee have any comment? We really haven't been taking much in the way of votes on anything, because maybe we did on the $150 fee, I don't remember, but I mean, if you want to make a motion, the committee adopt. We do have technically an opening because Tom Perry did agree to be on. He never came, but technically he was a member. Beverly?
I've been through the trial by fire when it comes to people who are totally against oyster farmers in certain bodies of water, and I think that it would be counterproductive to the committee to have someone who has already verbalized how strongly they feel against doing any kind of growing of oysters anywhere near where they live. Okay. So I don't want to go through that again. It's just too painful.
I understand. Hopefully you don't think Russ is that guy, because
he's not.
Pretty,
he's reasonable.
Yeah, he's pretty
reasonable.
And actually supports agriculture.
Yeah, he does.
He
wasn't you I was talking about. You know, you, have you been to meetings where you've seen these people?
That's a direct question. Yes, I mean, I've seen people. I used to work for the state, and we dealt with the whole gamut of people on both sides. I just will say some of those people could probably say the same about some of the industry members here today.
I'm sure.
So, and I mean that ultimately the commissioner, whoever makes a decision, you know, they can find out something about the people before they put them on. You know, you took a big chance on me, and you're probably regretting it.
No.
But anyway, it's you know, I know what you're getting at there with it. The other group I think is underrepresented, and I think Mark, you know, something Mark said made me think of it again, is the really small producer is, of course, the challenge there is finding somebody that can dedicate the time to come, but I think you're kind of missing that as well. But I do think you need some representation.
I would consider Tommy Leggett a small producer.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Medium. Small to medium.
Okay, I'm the
not AJ. You can't say you're small to
medium. I have a comment.
Go ahead. AJ.
So I agree with Russ. I'm happy to put another person on here, you know, that represents maybe the land, the Highland owner. I would make one request, though, or maybe if he does make a motion, a friendly amendment, that it not be from the same region as Lynn Haven or the Virginia Beach. It's maybe the Eastern Shore, or it's maybe the Northern Neck. So you get a different perspective from some of those landowners. The other comment I'll make, if I can, is I want to remind everybody that this is, you know, the Aquaculture Management Advisory Committee, so typically you're going to see a number of aquaculture members on here because that's what we do every day, so we have a lot of experience and knowledge to bring to the table. I understand, you know, Russ, we appreciate having you on the committee, and it was a good thing that you were appointed to the committee. But this industry provides a lot of benefits that aren't actually captured in a document, and we seem to kind of glance over that. I understand Becky's concern about, well, I guess I called them bad actors. But there was a bad actor in there, and they were holding up a mud hole of a lease, which was completely inappropriate for the city. And that's a bad actor. But we provide a lot of ecological benefit in this business at no cost. You all know that. VIMS knows that. I think everybody on this committee knows that. We put oysters in the water and shellfish and clams in the water, and they do a tremendous benefit to the bay and the public trust. So, anyways,
and
I'll stop
economy.
There.
And the economy.
All right, so I'll leave it open. If you want to do a motion, that's fine. If you don't, I'll certainly relay this to Ellen that Russ made it, and we had some heartburn with certainly putting someone on who's just anti-aquaculture. I don't think that's the purpose of this committee, is to put somebody on it that's just anti-aquaculture.
Right.
We do want to hear citizens' concerns and landowners' concerns, but again, if we agree to put another person on and agree that that person should be represent non-agriculture traditional interests, more like a landowner, certainly I agree. The commission would make an effort to pick someone who has an open mind, would look at the thing from both sides, while they may have a preference on, you know, landowners' rights and those types of things. We can go either way. Certainly, I think Ellen would entertain, you know, looking at that.
Yeah.
Well, I think I would ask that you err towards the side of the landowner's rights with that. If you look for somebody with balance, that's fine.
Okay. Well, we'll go with that.
AJ, do you want to make the motion? No. You don't? Strongest coming from you.
No, I'm fine. I'm taking it as a suggestion. I don't know if it needs to be. If you all want a motion,
well, that's up to y'all. I'm not going to make a motion, but if Russ wants to make a motion and we get a second, we'll vote on it.
I'm fine. I only offer my comment that I come from a different geographical area, so there's representation.
Dan, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
question?
Sure, Mike, go ahead.
Other advisory committees at DMRC, Blue Crab Committee, Shellfish Committee, am I in not understanding, but don't they all the members consist of participants in that fishery? Mm-hmm. And that this AMAC committee is a little different in that we have non-aquaculture participants that sit on the committee?
Andrew is shaking his head no, so I'm going to let him address that. I didn't really have a good answer for you, so go ahead, Andrew.
No, it's usually that they have an interest in it. There's no requirement that they're actually a member of the crab or fish or industry there. So SMAC has participants from CBF that aren't in there and different aspects of it too. And I think CMAC and FMAC as well. So they have non-harvesters, non-industry people. It's just a requirement that they have an interest in what's being discussed there. But all of them do have some industry representation.
Yep. Now that you said that, I tend to agree. And then most of these standing committees like this, the commissioner basically makes the decision on what mix he wants on them to get the proper perspective. So
I'd like to second AJ's comment then. I think having somebody who has a genuine interest in the topic, has another perspective. He said rural areas, let's say the Eastern Shore, Northern Neck, Gloucester, and even York County. I mean, it's just, we're mainly not talking about the Lynn Haven again.
That was my only, just look outside of the Lynn Haven, City of Virginia Beach area.
Right, because there's a range of issues, and they're different sometimes in Gloucester County than York County.
And we have had a request from someone to be on this committee, and we declined, because we do not believe that they would be the right person. For the very reasons you just talked about.
Thank you.
Well, we won't tell you who. Anything else?
See you in March.
Well, we'll stand adjourned then. Thanks for coming. Have a safe trip home in the fog and the rain. And, good luck surviving the General Assembly session. Not too much related to Oyster Ground, but there's definitely some many issues going on.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, thanks for calling in.
It's going to be an interesting.
Bye-bye. Bye.
AJ, what have you guys got in the session? What have you got that you're following closely?
Well, I mean,